Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You're listening to Fiber Talk, the midweek version of that twice-weekly podcast for people who... All right, we'll make fine art with needle and thread. We'll go highbrow. Yeah, yeah. Because you're back here, and so we're going to go highbrow and stay classy. Yeah. Yeah. Because I was going to go with impale cloth and be violent, but nah.
In honor of me having to actually work...
Yeah, that.
Not that the rest of the time I'm not working.
Right, right. Yeah. Now, thought about you many times last week going through sales meetings. Ick.
Yeah, sales meetings. So, yeah, and our business, our sales reps, because their customers are all over the country, so the sales reps are all over the country. So quarterly or whatever it is, they all descend upon us like locusts and... So we have to do the things where we eat dinner with them and stuff. So I kind of had to do that.
Yep. Yeah, this year, like I said last week, ours was one day, and most of the salespeople couldn't make dinner. So
you're lucky.
No kidding. I was out of there. We were done late afternoon. I was out of there. Goodbye. Yeah. Because, yeah, those dinners where the salespeople sit around for 3 hours having drinks and swapping sales stories, you know, just shoot me.
So, yeah. Sometimes it's fun. I mean, it depends kind of on the people, too.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, I'll tell you what, it's one of those things where you dread it, and then you get there, and the dinner itself is not that bad, but it's all the things you could have done with that time.
That's all that's ever in my mind. Is right now, I could be doing these things. Get me out of here. Yep.
Right, right. Yep. You know, especially if you've already worked a full day.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that salespeople tend to forget is those of us who aren't all day long when we were in meetings, there was a whole lot of work that needed to get done. And
right.
Yeah. And I really need to go do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's over for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Anasazi's song, still not done. I've had since last, first, thanks to everybody for all the comments and likes and so on and so forth to our podcast, particularly in the last week with Arlene and Teresa Vinette. Really been great hearing from everybody. And I always try to respond, but quite frankly, lately I haven't been able to keep up so many of them, and I've been pretty busy, so... thanks to everybody for listening and responding and offering comments. And a lot of people really enjoyed the last couple of them, so that's really neat. But, yeah, thanks. So, Anasazi's song, still not done? I can't get time. I cannot get time.
My Diamond Delight isn't done either.
No?
That makes you feel better.
A little bit, yeah. I just can't get time. And when I do have time, I'm nodding off, and I know that stitching when you're nodding off is just a recipe for redoing it. So
it is. You know, okay, so I'll tell you, for me, it's a little bit of a lack of time. So I have very little time to allocate to stitching. So part of it is, you know how we've talked about stitching serves a couple of different needs, and right. One of them is just the mindless need to just put needle and thread and stab cloth and just go back and forth and back and forth. So the sampler border that we're working on, that's a really good one for that. So when I get home from work or when I just have no more energy to expend, this border is 4,057 stitches long. So it's not really, I didn't count, I'm just making that up. But it's really good for that because it requires zero emotional or mental effort. So I've been kind of plugging away at that, but I'm kind of torn because one of the things we've talked about in sort of especially when we talk to designers is this idea that people are afraid to design projects because they can't get over the hump of, I don't know what to do, or I don't know what I would design, not even as a business, but as a, you know, just as a person, if I had to make a piece, what would I make it, you know? And I think for me, at least, doing surface embroidery is a little easier to imagine designing a piece because you can do monograms, you can do flowers, you can do, like, there's a lot of things that you can kind of take pieces of and put them together. So for me, doing a needlepoint piece is more intimidating. But lately, I don't know what it is. It's probably mental illness, quite frankly. Lately, I have so many ideas of things that I want to do and that I want to stitch that I'll be driving to work and something will come to mind, or like there'll be a challenge, a stitch challenge, and I'll be thinking about it and say, oh, there's nothing I can do. And then suddenly an idea will form in my head. Oh, that would be a way to do that. I really want to do that. And then I'm like, when am I going to do that? There's no way I can do that thing because I'm working on this other thing. And then I want to finish the project I'm working on. And, you know, I've got all these other things that I'm doing, but I've got the disease of each one is so exciting and tantalizing that I want to stitch it.
Yep.
So, and I fear that I'm going to forget them also. So I think what I need to start doing is writing them down or sketching them. And I can't draw. I'm not a good drawer. I'm a terrible artist in that regard. Like, I'm not good at putting pen to paper. So it will serve no other purpose than to remind me of what it was I was thinking of. So for things that don't have deadlines or like challenges or stitch alongs or things like that, I think I'm going to start writing them down.
Yeah.
But for the other things, like I'm really torn because there's a bunch of things that kind of have like deadlines for them and I want to do them all. And so I'm like this new person where everything is exciting. Not that that's a bad problem to have, but.
Right. Well, I caught myself the other day. I mean, I literally was ready to order something. It was, you know, oh, I've got to do that one. I got to have that. And I start to fill out the thing and I just stop myself halfway. What are you doing? You know, I got 20 things downstairs on the table, all started in one form or another. You know, stop it. Just stop it. And so I did.
Yeah.
I stopped. And
yeah.
Because it's, I mean, there's so much stuff that comes out that it's real easy to just, you know, yeah, I want that. And next thing you know, you got so much stuff and then you got to give it away or sell it because you know you'll never do it.
And, yeah. I don't even mind, like, those sorts of things. I think I'm better. I think that's where we differ, right? There's a lot of things where you and I contrast, and this is a funny one. So you end up being a collector because you want to have them, and so you have them in your stash. So you're more of a stash builder. And mine are more, you know, there's a project going on, and I have an idea, and I have to do it right this second. So my stash is very small. I think I have just a few things in a stash that are, you know, projects for a rainy day when I have nothing else to do. My problem is that, you know, there's projects that have sort of an immediacy that I need to do them right now. And I can't because I don't have, you know, I have to support a family. So this is when I, you know, start relying on this must be a mental illness kind of thing, because then I'm like, oh, and I want to learn how to frame it too. And, you know, I want to learn how to do this. And it, you know, there comes a limit of the things that you can do. You can't do all the things.
Yeah, you can't. That's true.
No. But in my head, sometimes I think I can.
Yeah. Well, there's that. I think I'll have this done faster than you ever really will. And then because I'm going to have it done next week, then therefore I can do this and this and this. And then the next week comes and goes and you're not done and you never were going to be done. And
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yep. Or something takes way longer than you think it's going to take. You know?
It always does. It always does. Yeah. Well, there have been two of these lately and I've experienced it. So I put it on the list for today. And Shoban Danielle Erica Fallows, I guess that was all one person, in Stitch Mania, who posted a week or so ago, just spent the best part of 20 minutes or more looking for a needle I was using. only to find out it was still attached to a bit of thread I had just finished using and was about to throw away in a pile of thread snippings. Just leave me here. I don't deserve my brain anymore, feeling like a moron. And, you know, it's kind of funny. But, and then somebody else posted another one similar. And, you know, I've been there where you drop a needle and it goes in the carpet and you can't find it. And, you know, when you're going to discover it, if you don't find it, you know, when you're going to discover it, it's when you're walking barefoot and, you know, you're going to step square on it. And, you know, so I, you know, this was kind of funny, like, but, you know, be grateful it was in a piece of thread in a pile and not in the carpet. And, you know, I get down on my hands and knees and with magnets and, you know, just kind of sweep the carpet looking for them. And, but it's a panic thing when at least it is for me, when that needle goes, especially if it's like a little 28er, you mm-hmm. know, and then you look down, you hear it hit. And then you look down and it's incredible ability to bounce. And yeah, you got to find that needle because, yeah, and even worse, it's going to be a family member. It's not going
to
be you.
Yes, I was just about to say, for me, I don't ever find them, but my husband does.
Lovely.
Yeah, he's not real happy when he finds them either.
It's like when we had kids and they'd leave those Legos, those little
Legos,
pieces.
Legos, oh. Yeah. So for pins, because I use pins a lot on pieces just to mark kind of where I am and just as notes sometimes, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
if I count off something and I don't want to grid it or something like that, I use pins. So, but those, I always use the big ball-headed pins.
Yeah.
And it's not so much because they're easy to see on the fabric. It's so that when I drop them, which I will... I can find them because for me, it's not the carpet. It's usually in the couch cushions.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, see where I stitch, I have a, it's on carpet. So I have a, an office chair, hard plastic office chair mat and then an office chair. But then my stand is right over carpeting. So if I drop it and it goes on the mat, of course, then it bounces to the carpet. You know, heaven forbid it would stay on the mat. That would just be not right. And otherwise, then, it goes on the carpet. So I'm just, yeah. And it's a kind of a grayish-type carpet, so the needle blends right in. And so I'll be down there with a flashlight and a magnet trying to see a reflection or hope I just pass the magnet over the needle somewhere along the way. And yeah. But, no, I appreciated the panic in the post, you know, mm-hmm. you feel like an idiot afterwards, but, no, at the time it's quite serious. Yeah. And oh man, in the couch, ouch, my butt.
Yeah. It's usually between the cushions. That's
yeah, okay.
Not always. So we empathize.
And you have a dog too. So you got that extra risk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's, the dropping of the needles. Not popular. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. On my lap stand, I'm looking at it right now. I have about 12, I'm not even kidding, 12 magnets, like the actual magnet, not even the pretty ones, glued to the stand. With like liquid nails glue.
Really?
Yeah. So I'll usually put needle minder magnets on the piece, but then I also put like on the lap part of the stand and then on the, like the sidebars, I'll also glue magnets everywhere. Just because it's just handy because then I can store, you know, threaded needles, not threaded needles, pins, scissors.
Yeah,
I can actually magnet, like sometimes I'll cut out a motif when I'm stitching it and I could just magnet it to the stand like that. So I'm a big fan of gluing because the magnets themselves are really, really cheap. So you can just buy them that way and just glue them on.
So you're kind of like a guitar player with guitar
picks.
Picks
everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
how
so
cool are you?
So I'm going to start a new feature on the podcast.
Okay.
I was thinking about this all of the 2 weeks, right? So the name of the new feature is things that are self-evident once you do them, but are really, really dumb. Okay?
Okay.
So,
all right.
Number one of things that are self-evident that you should know but that are really, really dumb is if you are gluing magnets to a stand and the magnets are, you know, you put glue on the bottom of the magnet and you stick it to the stand, you can't glue another magnet an inch away.
Yes.
Right away.
Yes.
Because the glue has not yet set.
Right.
And as soon as you put that magnet down, because these are very, very strong magnets, the magnet jumps right over to its friend, and now you have two magnets with glue all over them.
I was going to say, with wet glue everywhere, yes.
Right. So what you have to do is you have to stage it, and you have to glue. And, of course, as soon as you that happens, and this is the point of this whole piece, as soon as that happens, you think to yourself, well, of course that happened, dummy. And you just have that moment of, oh, you know, why didn't I think of that? You know, because of course. So what you do is, you know, you glue, I glue sort of like one, if they are positioned 1 to 10, you glue 1, 4, and 9 on one day, and then you come back and you glue 2, 6, and then you come back and, you know, so you have to stage it. You can't glue them all in one day. Episode number one.
Excellent.
So basically, it's going to be...
The look on your face, I can just see the look. You put that one down, and the other one jumps up to meet it.
And you're like, And there's a couple of other things that I've done recently where I'm like, wow, that was just colossally dumb. And like, really, there's no excuse for not knowing to not do that before you did it.
Yes.
And yet it took me doing it to go, wow, that was really dumb.
Uh-huh. Especially someone who at the core of your everyday existence is science. Yes, it's
well, it's I don't even know. It's okay, so I'll throw in a freebie, okay? So here's freebie number two.
Okay.
So we've talked before about ways to mark a canvas so that you don't have to grid it. So especially large canvases where you need to know kind of where you are.
Yep.
And people have different methods. So they can either mark it with a pen, or you can stitch a grid into it, or, you know, we've with a sampler, with a border, Jacqueline had talked about where she stitches just half of a cross all the way up to the stitch number 10, and then she stitches a full cross, and then she goes on. And so every 10th one is a full cross, and so it serves as a proxy grid, right? So you can see every 10th stitch, you know where you are.
Right.
So as I'm stitching the sampler, I've tried every method. Like I've started gridding it, and I'm like, no, that's, you know, it's just going to be too much of a pain because it's gigantic, so I don't want to do that. So I thought, oh, let me do Jacqueline's method, right? So I start doing this. And if you don't remember, the fabric that I'm using, I'm not using a white fabric like most everybody else is doing, or a light colored fabric. I'm using a pretty much a denim, almost a denim colored fabric. And the border is sort of a medium toned green, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tonally, these the fabric and the thread are pretty close, right?
Right, yep. Mm-hmm.
So I'm stitching happily along, doing my, you know, half stitch, my half cross, doing a 10, and then every 10th stitch I do my cross. And I do this for about 40 stitches, and then I sit back to admire my work and look down and realize I can't even tell where the 10th stitch is. Because they are so tonally close, and it will serve perfectly well as a border, because also in there it's metallic, because I also have blending filament in it, which is going to reflect light, which makes it even harder to see when there is a full stitch or half stitch. So if you're going to use that trick, you have to make sure that your background fabric and your thread actually look different. Things that should be obvious, but aren't until you do them and you look at it and say, wow, that really should have been obvious. Until you do it and you say, that really is not an effective technique with this particular combination.
You're on a roll. I'm impressed.
Yep. I have another one saved for next week, too.
Okay. Okay.
It's an even better one.
Oh, my.
It's an even dumber one. I outdid myself with dumbness.
All right. So we have that to look forward to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I will say this, though. So these are all things that I'm doing in the interest of learning. So it's all things that I'm trying. When you do things, right? So this is the idea and sort of the mantra that I always go by, which is fail, but fail quickly. So I'm always trying things that I've never done before. And the idea is I'm going to try it. And, you know, a lot of them are not going to work. And I'm okay with that, right? So I will try things that people will, like I'm framing a piece up now that I've never framed a piece before. So there's going to be a lot of stops and starts there, things that I do and say, no, that didn't work. I have to try it a different way. Or, you know, you're going to learn. You have to learn by doing things the wrong way so that you figure out what the right way is. And there's only so much you can learn from, unless you watch someone do it, there's only so much you can learn from, reading instructions or watching a video. Because that person's going to do all the right things.
Yes.
You have to learn the wrong things by doing them. So I'm going to shortcut all of that for a lot of people by telling you all of the wrong things that I'm doing. Because that's what people don't do, right? There's no book of here's all the wrong things you can do. There's only a book of all the right things you can do.
There'd be a book.
Right?
Yeah.
Don't do this.
Right.
A book of needlework.
Mm-hmm. That would be a book, yes. Sounds like you're well on your way to chapter one of this book.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you are.
A handy hint of anti-tips and tricks.
Yes. Yep. I'm still enjoying the mental image of gluing down the second magnet and having the first glue everywhere.
And I'm just sitting there, just took a moment to kind of look down and say, yeah, you really should have thought that out a little bit better. Because that's you know better. You know what magnets do. And yet you still did it.
You did it anyway, yep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that you mentioned about how cheap magnets are.
Yes.
And, you know, for people who like to have a lot of needle minders, they don't have to be the fancy ones. You can just buy a bunch of those magnets.
Yes.
And just use just the raw magnets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't need to.
My secret source, there's a company called K&J Magnetics online. You can look it up. And I've been buying magnets from them for various and sundry reasons for a very long time. And they literally have every size and shape of small neodymium, the rare earth metal magnets, the very, very super strong ones, for very inexpensive. So the only thing is you have to use special glue, but you can get the glue at, you know, any hardware store. But you can glue them to lots of things. So I just find it really handy to have magnets kind of everywhere because I just misplace things really easily. So if I can stick my scissors to my frame, then I don't find them in the couch cushions and I don't find them, you know, everything is handy because it's all stuck there, right? So my pins are there, my scissors are there, the threaded needles are all on one side, the ones that I've run through and are ready to be threaded go on the other side. There's just magnets everywhere. And like some of them are more expensive than others. It depends on the size, it depends on the strength, but really, really inexpensive. And then you just glue them on and they're there. And you can do them on, I imagine you could do that on an embroidery hoop, although it would be a little bit less functional because then you've got this hoop that you can't really spin around and work with. But on a, you could do it on a floor stand. You could actually do it on your light. I can't think of a good reason why you couldn't do that. It's just really handy. They're really good for a lot of things. So KNJ Magnetics. And they sell rubber-coated ones, too.
And they're not particularly expensive, are they?
No, I mean, these magnets, I think, depending on the size and shape, and a lot of times they have, like, seconds that are, you know, we bought a whole bunch of magnets and they weren't good for the thing that we needed them for, so we'll sell them off at 10 cents a piece or 20 cents a piece. And even the ones that are full price are, you know, 40 cents a piece. I mean, really, they're very inexpensive.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, that's, you know, that's something, I mean, we all like to have the fancy needle minders because they're fun, and some people will have a needle minder for a project, and but yeah, you don't have to. You just buy the magnets like that.
I'm all about pretty and having pretty things like that, but I am also about functional. So having things that don't make my husband hate me for stepping on needles, I'm all about that.
Yeah, that's a good motivation right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Family defense.
Yeah, that. Keeping myself out of the doghouse.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Someone else had posted this. You know, this comes up every now and then. The question about whether to put your canvas on top of the stretcher bars or on the bottom. And I always find it interesting because somebody will post it every now and then because they'll have heard about putting them on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And then it always starts this discussion that basically if you tallied up the top people versus the bottom people, it'd probably come out about even every time.
Yes, but everybody has a very strong reason for choosing their thing.
Right. And they're all legitimate.
Yeah.
You know, they're all legitimate. And, but somebody posted one the other day, and so I was just kind of reading them and just enjoying the, and it's just to repeat. But, you know, it's, I do both. Like if I'm on a small, stretcher bar setup, like 6x6 or 8x8, I'll tend to mount the canvas on the bottom because it's the small ones where I tend to find myself banging the needle against the stretcher bars, trying to end off a thread or begin a thread or any number of things. So on the smaller ones, I'll put it on the bottom. But on the bigger ones, I don't know why I like it on the top. I do. I prefer it.
I on do top. Too, yeah.
So I tend to do that on the bigger ones. And then, of course, then the reaction is we'll just get more canvas. You know, and have more margin around the edges. But I don't know. It just always seems to work better. I think one of the best arguments for putting it on the bottom is that it tends to keep your hands away from the stitching.
Yes, I agree. I think that is a good argument for that because you're not resting your hand as much on what you're doing.
Right.
But I think that if that's a big concern, I like the idea that a lot of people use with just putting saran wrap.
Yes.
I think it's probably uncomfortable, but it would probably work. And for me, I think if I was working on something that was that much of a concern, I would probably entertain the idea of using cotton gloves or something with just the fingertips cut off. Yeah. That's probably where I would go with it because saran wrap would get sticky. That said, when I do embroidery in a hoop, I always use saran wrap. It just makes the hoop hold better and it just works a ton better. But while we're talking about scroll frames, I wanted to ask you a question. So working on this piece, I've worked on scroll frames before and they've worked out fine. What I am finding with this one is stretching linen, it stretches fine top to bottom, but I'm having a bear of a time getting it to tension side to side. And I found a really, really cool tip in the new book from the Royal School that actually was stolen from their slate frame technique.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to, before I talked about that, I wanted to see what you do to get tension from side to side. Because well, I was, before I read this, I was trying all kinds of ridiculous things to try to get it to draw tight on the side. And then I read what the Royal School does, and then it made perfect sense.
Yeah, I'm curious on that, because the Sarah Parr sampler, I have a great deal of trouble where, like, you'll get little ridges because it needs to be pulled from the sides. Mm-hmm. And so I had mentioned a few weeks back about someone had used those mitten clips with elastic.
Yes.
And wrapped those around the vertical bars and then clipped them onto the side of the linen to pull it tight. So I'm going to, I was thinking, now I'm curious to hear what you're going to say. So I was going to get those for that one. But then when I put Sarah Brazier on the 36-inch rods and rolled it up and tightened it up, then I did not have that problem. It was nice and tight all the way across. So I could not figure out why. And the Sarah Parr linen, I have pulled off twice to try and get it to be tighter and not have little ridges, and have had no luck. But then when I, yeah, this Sarah Brazier at 30 inches wide on 36-inch bars, no problem at all. It's tight all the way across. So there's some physics involved there that I don't understand, and it may just be the cloth itself. But that's the only solution I know. I know two solutions, that one, and then basically use like a slate frame and lace it to the side. But then when you have to roll up, when you're ready to roll up, then you have to undo all that lacing. So that's not appealing to me. So now I'm curious about what you learned from the Royal School.
Right. So I had started doing exactly that kind of lacing through the sides, and with the idea that, you know, when you roll up, you have to undo the lacing. I had stitched actually a blanket stitch along the edge of where I just did the section where I was working, because I was kind of experimenting. And then I tied strings, just basically just regular string, to each side. So instead of lacing it as a continuous thing, I tied individual strings, almost like the mitten clips, so that if I rolled up, I could take out one string and slide the rest up, right?
Yeah.
And what I found was that the buttonhole stitch was just not sufficient to pull, right? It didn't hold the fabric tight enough because the thread was going to tear. And I used carpet thread, like upholstery thread. So that was a no-go. So it just wasn't working. So what the Royal School does with the slate frames, and they recommend the same thing with scroll frames, is, you know, the webbing, the cotton webbing that you have that is at the top of the roller bars?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's stapled
like twill
on.
Tape or whatever it is, yeah.
Yes, it's like cotton webbing. It's not exactly like twill tape that you would use in sewing, but it's basically the same thing. You buy cotton webbing. It's what you would use if you wrapped embroidery hoops. It's the same stuff, but it's heavier than twill tape that you would buy to use on a hem or something like that. But you can get it anywhere, yards and yards of it. I think I got mine on Amazon for embroidery hoops, but you buy, you know, a big roll of it, and you have it forever. So what they do is, before they mount the canvas, they stitch. In fact, I think they hand stitched to the edge of the fabric this webbing, this cotton webbing, and then they take heavy string, like pretty much it's almost like the heaviness of twine. So
oh
my. It's not thread at all, but it's like that density. So like you'd get it at a hardware store, that kind of string, and they use not even a needle. It's like almost like a hook, and they go around and they lace it that way. So as you're rolling up, you sort of slip knot it at one end. So as you're rolling up, you just undo the slip knot and you pull out the top, you roll up, and then you just kind of pull it out of the top and you let it unravel at the top, and then you just lace it back through the bottom. So if you imagine the lacing almost like a spiral, that goes through your fabric, it unspirals out of the top if it's rolling down, and then spirals through the bottom. Or you could just take it out and redo it if that's very quick and easy to do, because it's only through, you know, three or four times. But it's, you know, very, very heavy lacing string, I guess, for lack of a better term, and it's put through with a very heavy duty needle, like a, not even an upholstery needle, like a, it's even heavier than that. So when they do that, they're able to get really, really good tension. So it's laced exactly like a scroll frame, like a slate frame would be done. But the trick is stitching this webbing onto the fabric before you start. So that's the key.
Well, that's most interesting, because that, yeah, because you can really pull on that then.
Exactly, exactly. So if I was doing it, I would either, and they just recommend just doing a basting stitch, I would have probably just run this through the machine.
I was going to say, just run it right up through the machine. Yeah, be done with it.
Yeah. And with this, I mean, it's tough because the piece itself is so wide that it, on my frame, it just barely fits. But even if you folded it a little bit, just to get that webbing in there, that way you would be able to, because you don't want to go through your linen, because the linen just doesn't have enough heft to it to be able to hold that right. much tension at a single point, but the webbing does. So you're transferring the force of a single piece of string that's going to pull really hard over many, many stitches between the webbing and the linen. So that's how it works. So basically, you treat it like a slate frame, and that's how they do it.
Okay, two Smart, questions. Right? Two questions. Yeah. One, are you, when you, this canvas webbing, are you laying it right over the edge of the linen so that the canvas webbing is into the linen, say, a half inch or however wide it is, and flush with the side of the linen, or are you letting it stick out away from the side of the linen, and that's what you're lacing to?
The second. They overlap. I think, I'm not going to quote the book exactly, but I think they had it overlap by a third or two-thirds.
And sewn on. So then you're, when you do the side lacing, it's only into the canvas webbing.
Correct. It is not through the linen at all.
Okay.
I'm looking right now, actually. No, it's through the webbing.
Webbing only.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then second question. Now you have this webbing on the sides. And so when you roll up the linen on these on the horizontal scroll bars, now you have two ends that are raised up higher than the other linen. Seems to me that would affect the tension vertically. Maybe not. That doesn't, that you haven't noticed the difference?
It doesn't seem to. No, it doesn't seem to.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. And I just checked the needle that they use is called a bracing needle.
Bracing, as in BRACING?
Correct.
Hmm.
So all of this is from the Royal School of Needlework, just published a new book. What they did was they've been publishing little books. They're sort of spiral bound books that each of them encompasses the different areas of focus that their intensive courses cover. So they had a crewel work, a white work, a black work, a silk shading book. So they put all of those books together into one, which is a giant hardcover book, which was just published within the last month or so. And I highly, highly recommend it. It's not as expensive as I would imagine it to be, and not nearly as expensive as I would be willing to pay for it, quite frankly. It is a tremendous resource. It has, of all of these different styles, it has the basics, like I said, of you know, needle and thread, frames, how to lace, how to do all those things. And then it goes into depth of each of these different styles. It's a great book. So you can find it on Amazon, Royal School of Needlework, Book of Embroidery. It's a fantastic book. It's a really, really good resource.
Well, there we go. May have to get one.
I mean, obviously they didn't have a trick about magnets because that would have saved me some trouble, but.
Yeah. Well, plus now you've given me an excellent mental image there, so I'm fine with that. You know, I got no problem whatsoever with that.
But see, that's the thing, you know, so you learn the right way to do things, but it's these little tips of things like I'm sitting stitching and one of the things that I'm doing is the Bonnefeifer, you go down with the tip of the needle and you come back with the eye of the needle. Mm-hmm. And it, when you do that, none of the thread ever twists. Right. That is one of the best tips I ever heard.
Yes, it is. Govana.
It really is, because I'm working with one piece of DMC and one piece of blending filament, and to have to not worry about them constantly twisting around each other, my life is so much better because of that one little tip.
Yep. No, it's an excellent tip. For that, you know, anybody, two threads of any kind, yep, excellent. Really does save a lot of time, a lot of hassle. It's a bit of a habit to break, to not turn that needle underneath and come up with the point, but...
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It feels weird at first, and then after you get used to it, it feels weird not to do it.
You got to post a couple pictures of how you're doing there, because I think, well, I know I am. A lot of people are curious about Sarah Brazier Christine style.
Yeah. Right now, it's just a lot of lines. So, and to be honest, it's really tough to photograph to catch what's going on because the metallics don't reflect well in photographs.
Yep.
So it may be one of those, I'm going to have to fool around with the camera and see if I can figure it, or I may have to do a little bit of video. So it kind of catches light.
Yeah.
But it's different.
So this, when you do the string through the twill, then are you knotting it and then pulling it through the twill, the canvas webbing?
No, not at all. So you do a slip knot on one end.
Okay.
And then it's like a slinky. That's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
You go down through the fabric and then you come up around your frame and then you go down through the fabric, up around the frame. You just make like a slinky. And then you do a slip knot at the end. And you just basically maintain a piece of this string that's about the length that you need to do that along the side of your scroll frame. And for the amount of time that you're working in that area, you keep it. And then when you're ready to roll, you undo your slip knots. And if you're rolling up, you would unlace, let's say, the first 3 inches or so. If you roll up 3 inches, you do that. You pull your thread through. So now you have your slack at the bottom. And then you lace that slack through. And then you slip knot at the top, slip knot at the bottom, and you're ready to go.
Very slick. It's almost like the Royal School people actually know what they're doing.
Like they've done this before, right?
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give that a try. Because I have the canvas twill and the sewing machine, and I'm pretty sure I have string, too. So, yeah. Because you can see how that would be very nice and taut.
Yeah, and working on a piece of fabric this big, I can tell you, because mine is very kind of wobbly right now, it would be awful nice if it was drum tight, because it would go a lot faster.
Yeah. All right, good tip. And the Royal School of Needlework Book of Embroidery.
Yes.
I will put a link on the page for this week's show so people can find it at the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And get it. Excellent.
If nothing else, there's stunning eye candy in it.
Yeah, I'm sure of that, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful work.
So we're going to buy magnets from K&J and an incredible book from Amazon.
Yes.
Okay, that's a good week right there, I think. Mm-hmm. That's it. Sunday, Melinda Cole of Merry Wind Farm. Had a fun conversation with Melinda about all the things that she does there. And her business is Merry Wind Farm, and she lives on Merry Wind Farm, so named. And, yeah, that was fun. So that'll be coming up Sunday. Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll be back, just the two of us, next Wednesday.
Take care.